started 1 minute early so that we can have maximum time for our speaker. So you can see what Jerry's title is going to be for the talk and also what her position is. But the position doesn't really tell us why you should listen to her. So I'm going to give you a little bit more information about why you should listen to Jerry today. You know, how do we in our profession judge the value of someone's knowledge and ideas? Well, we actually have a lot of benchmarks for that. You know, we might ask, well, how many times has someone asked her to talk to them, invited talks? Well, Jerry's given over 100 of these invited talks. Or we might ask, who pays them? Or how often does she get paid to implement her ideas? She's had over 50 research grants. She's been the director of three centers for excellence in research in autism, and has been the founding director of a privately funded service provision center for children with autism. Or another way we might judge the value of her ideas and knowledge is whether her professional peers think that she's worth publishing. So she's published over 150 peer-reviewed journal articles. Or we might ask whether funding agencies or legislative bodies ask to hear her opinions. So she's given expert opinions to Congress on several autism-related topics and to several NIH consensus panels on autism-related topics. Or we might ask whether other professionals ask for her advice. She serves on three scientific advisory boards, including the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center, 10 professional advisory boards, 5 conference review boards, and is a grant reviewer for 5 funding agencies. So sometimes people like Jerry get too busy to wonder if they're really having an impact on the field. But I don't think Jerry really needs to worry about this, because parent organizations and autism advocacy groups have named her an autism hero, an honoree of research excellence, medical professional of the year, and she got the award for outstanding service. So you're really in for a treat today, and I mean that in all sincerity. We will have an hour talk. This will end about 5:10, and then there'll be about 5 minutes of questions, and I hope you'll join us for wine and treats in the lobby afterwards. I give you Jerry Dawson.
Well, that was a very generous introduction, and I thank you for that, Paul. And let me just start by saying how thrilled I am to be here, and what a marvelous day that I've had. It's really a neurons to neighborhood kind of place, and I've started out with getting into the most intricacies of the cell, you know, with Randy Blakely, and then went on, you know, to talk to people studying behavior and brain, and then also community interventions. And what was so amazing as I went through the day was how it wasn't just isolated people studying, you know, each of these levels analysis, which would be, of course, impressive enough, but people were really making links across these levels of analysis that, you know, you don't see in many places. So I just want to convey how impressed I am and how fortunate all of you are to be, you know, in this really creative setting. In fact, you stole away one of my prime research assistants. Where's Kristen? There she is. So treat her nicely. She's from my lab. All right. I hope I don't have this feedback problem. See what's going on here. So today I'm going to be talking about early intervention, brain plasticity, and I'm going to use the word prevention of autism. Partly because people are actually starting to think about this, and also to be a little provocative, and hopefully in the question and answer period we can talk about whether, you know, we're ready for that word in autism or not. So an overview of today's talk, I want to begin by just reviewing some of the new approaches to early detection in autism. And then I'm going to introduce a concept that I'm referring to as risk processes. I think most of us are familiar with the idea of risk factors, but I also want to think about the processes that occur between genetics, for example, and outcome that may mediate how those risk factors actually become manifest in a syndrome. And then finally, we will talk a little bit about the idea that early intervention and what kind of influence it can have on development, and how we might measure whether it could influence not only behavioral development but brain development. I'm trying to use this, and I'll stay away from that. Okay. So, beginning with early detection, what do we know? As you may be aware, we started out by studying home videotapes. A lot of this work was done in my own laboratory. One of the first studies that we did on this was the first birthday party study that we did in 1994. At that point, people really didn't think you could diagnose autism below about age 3. And so it was remarkable to see that at first birthday parties that you could differentiate children that went on to develop autism from those that had typical development, and then later we were able to distinguish those kids from children who had developmental delay but not autism. There's been a nice review of now what is a large program of research in the area of home videotapes that was published in 2006. And what we can conclude at this point, one of the surprises is that symptoms don't seem to be apparent in the first 6 months of life. In fact, the first case study that I published of an infant, that 13-month-old with autism, it was interesting that the medical records said that the child at 6 months was very engaged and very responsive, and that between 6 and 12 months is when the symptoms began to emerge. And it raises some very interesting questions about what brain systems come online in the second half of the first year of life and how that may impact autism. We also know that there's the earliest symptoms that you see at around 12 months include a failure to orient to name, reduced eye contact, and reduced social smiling. Although, as you'll see in a minute from some of the new studies following infants prospectively, we now have even a richer picture of what's happening early on. So by 12 months, impairments in joint attention are very apparent, especially pointing to share information and referential gaze, so looking back and forth from an object that might be being spoken about or pointed to from the speaker to the object. So those kinds of impairments are there by 12 months of age. Now, we can always also use videotapes to validate the phenomenon of regression. Now, parents have been telling us for many years that 25% of children have this pattern of apparently normal development followed by regression, but we didn't know whether it might be that the parents just didn't detect these early symptoms or whether this was a true phenomenon. So this was the first really objective validation of the phenomenon of regression, which and we use videotapes to do this. And what you see here is we had three groups of children: those whose parents reported early onset, those whose parents reported typical development followed by regression, and those then typical babies that did not develop autism. And you can see at 12 months of age, and this is a first birthday party. The kids with early onset were already showing reduced babbling, whereas here are the regressed kids. And this isn't statistically different, but it was interesting that they actually had more babbling. One of the kind of comments that I've heard is that is in Rett syndrome, you sometimes see an acceleration in development before regression. And so that's just kind of an interesting observation. But then if you look at 12 months or 24 months of age, you can see now, looking at phrase speech, that you've had this explosion of language in the typical kids over that year. The early onset kids continue to fail to develop language, but now look at the regressed kids. So they are now showing poor language. So that was a pretty strong validation of the phenomenon. Now, one of the things that we also asked, we asked parents whether they saw any kind of symptoms early on. We had a questionnaire where we asked about sleep and eating and interaction and so forth. And what we found was that the children with this regressive pattern, that the parents did report that early on these kids had problems in the area of what we call regulatory skills. So things like sleeping and eating and soothing they were having problems on with. So it does suggest that there might be a vulnerability there that was underlying the condition even before the onset of regression. And I should say we've now published studies where we've looked at, I'll be talking in a minute about the atypical pattern of head growth that you see associated with autism. And we now have published a study where we showed that even these children with regression are showing this atypical pattern of head growth before they become symptomatic. So then the studies began on infants who are at risk for autism by virtue of having an older sib. So what we know is that if you have one child in the family with autism, that on a population basis, the risk of the second child having autism is about 1 in 20. And so what then people began to launch studies, and this was really pioneered by Lonnie Zweigenbaum and also people like Marion Sigmund, where they followed infants prospectively who had an older sib. And by doing this, they could map the onset and development of autism prospectively, as well as to look at all the variations in which the onset might occur. And what you can see, so Lonnie Zweigenbaum developed something called the Autism Observation Scale for Infants, and he found that infants that went on to develop autism, that they showed between 6 and 12 months of age a passivity and decreased activity. They showed extreme distress reactions and an overly fixation on objects. And then by 12 months of age, you saw decreased affect and social smiling, delayed gesture, poor eye contact, failure to orient and aim, and poor imitation. Now, the other thing he found was this what we call sticky attention or poor disengagement of attention, which is interesting from the point of view of thinking about the systems that come online in the brain the second half of the first year. So this is the tendency to, if you're looking at a stimulus, and in fact the way this is clinically administered is you show the object, and then while the child's looking at the object, you introduce another object in the periphery. So very similar to the Posner type paradigm, where you look to see whether there's disengagement of attention and movement of attention to a peripheral stimulus. And he found that the babies that were going on to develop autism showed this sticky attention, and suggesting that maybe these frontal systems that people think might underlie the development of more flexible allocation of attention in the second half of the first year of life, that this might, you know, be related to this feature in these young children at risk for autism. So currently, this area of coming up with new approaches to detect risk is really blossoming. Mainly because of this new methodology of following infants at risk. Because once you have a sample that you can follow prospectively and you know a certain percentage, and by the way, in these studies, we're finding that the prevalence, or I guess the risk, the recurrence rate of autism in these infant sibs is much higher than what had been estimated in populations. Now, this could be a selection factor, but so usually we're finding maybe 15% of kids that are SIBs are developing autism. And so there's a lot of different methodologies now that are being explored to look at early risk markers. So just to give you an idea, at a biological level, there's interest in atypical head circumference trajectory, certainly looking at various autism susceptibility genes and a number of peripheral biomarkers. Second, in the behavioral domain, things like disengagement of attention. There's a whole domain of research now that's looking at different aspects of just visual processing, face perception, and I'll talk about a little bit about that work, eye tracking methodologies, and just some early symptoms mostly focused on temperament. And then in the brain imaging area, people are looking at event-related brain potentials, EEG spectral analysis, EEG coherence, mu wave attenuation, MEG, fMRI during sleep, and MRI and MRS. So there's a lot of work going on trying to understand both biological, behavioral, and brain imaging risk factors in these young infants. I would say over the next several years, this is going to be a very informative area where we'll see lots of interesting and new findings coming out. So in our lab, we've been particularly interested in an ERP response as a possible early risk indicator called the N170. And the reason why I was particularly interested in this face-sensitive ERP response is I think of it a little bit like if you wanted to do the genetics or look at risk factors for heart attack, you need some sort of quantitative measure of biological systems that put you at risk. So this would be things like blood pressure and, say, cholesterol level, right? This is what you go in and you get screened for, and then people say, well, you're at higher risk for a heart attack. So what would you do for autism, right? What would be a quantitative measure? Well, if you do think that autism involves impairments in social brain circuitry, wouldn't it be neat to have a little tap on how well is your social brain circuitry working? So the way I like to think about this ERP response is you can get a latency, right, that tells you just how quickly does your brain recognize a face. And it's kind of like just going in and tapping that social brain circuitry and getting a sense of how well it's working. So just to give you an idea, these are actual data taken out of an article where they were recording from the surface of the brain of an individual who was about ready to undergo surgery. They're measuring from the fusiform gyrus, and they're showing the person this non-face stimulus, and you can see what the EEG looks like. Now, this is what the ERP looks like when you show a face. And what you see here is this very nice deflection at about 170 milliseconds. It's in a negative going wave. And it, you can measure the amplitude of this, and you can also measure the latency from the point at which the stimulus is shown. So again, this is my little blood pressure check of the social brain circuitry. So we decided to investigate this in individuals with autism. We've now looked at it also. We've looked at it in children, infants, adolescents, and even parents. And if we have time, I could talk about some of the work that's now being done using this as an endophenotype in genetic studies. But this was the first study that we published on this, Jamie McPartland's master thesis. And what you can see here is we got a nice N170, and then this is adolescents with autism. But the adolescents with autism not only showed a delayed response in terms of latency, but also a much lower amplitude response. We then looked at this in young children, and we saw the same kind of effect. This is the work of Sarah Webb in our lab, who Kristen used to work for and with. And looking at the latency of the N170, you can see in the autism group as compared to typically developing children and developmentally delayed children that you see this unusual response with a very long latency to faces as compared to objects. Now, these are three-year-olds with autism, where we're collecting ERPs to faces and objects. Now, one of the things you can do when you measure event-related potentials is you can map a component across the surface of the scalp, and then look at its topography. So what I've mapped here in these 3 to 4 year olds is the N170. And this is the typical three-year-olds, and here are the three-year-olds with autism. So one of the things you can see here is that there's a failure of the normal kind of right hemisphere specialization for faces, and you can see this in the topography. Now, so people have gone on to use this methodology now to start to look at infant risk, and this is the work of Leslie Carver. So Leslie was a postdoc at my lab, came out of Chuck Nelson's lab, and she helped to do those early studies of three-year-olds, and then she went on to become assistant professor at UC San Diego and has now conducted the same kind of paradigm, but using it with infants at risk. And just showing you her data, so what we see here is what the N170 looks like in, adults, so trying to get this down, adults, which is this one in red. When you test infants, they have an N170 type response, but given that their little immature brains are slower, you see this usually at about 290 milliseconds. Then they have this later going response of P400. But you can still measure its latency quite nicely. And so what she looked at was the latency of the N170, or what's really the N290 and the P400, to faces versus objects. And what you should see is a much faster and more robust response to faces than objects. So in a typical adult experiment, this would be the kind of stimuli that you would show. And in her infant risk sample, these were, she substituted and said, objects that babies were familiar with. So these are latency differences to that, to the peaks, looking at objects versus faces, starting with the P400. So in the control infants, what we saw was a faster P400 to faces than objects, showing a face advantage, but in the high-risk infants, they actually showed an object advantage. Looking at the N290s, similar kind of finding where we actually didn't show an advantage, Leslie didn't show an advantage for controls, but the high-risk infants showed a much stronger object advantage in this paradigm. So they are now following these infants, because these were infants at risk, they haven't been diagnosed yet, to look at whether these early ERP patterns are predictive of which infants develop autism. And Chuck Nelson with Helen Tucker-Fusberg at Harvard and Boston University are also doing a lot of work in this area, as well as Mark Johnson over in the UK. So there'll be a lot of this kind of studies coming out in the next several years. So what are some of the new directions, though, that people are heading in terms of using EEG as an early risk marker? A couple of possible measures that that will be used and are being used in studies, but there aren't data yet on infants. First is this EEG mu wave, which is a possible correlate of the mirror neuron system. And the second is a measure called EEG coherence, which looks at functional connectivity in the brain. So what I wanted to do is just to show you a couple of studies where we were the first to use these kinds of measures with populations of people with autism. Now, these are adolescent or adult studies, because we wanted to first see if there was a difference, and then with the idea that then you could downward extend this to looking at young infants. So as you know, there's been a lot of interest in the concept of that autism might be related to some dysfunction in the mirror neuron system, which is a system that allows you to map one's own body movements onto the body movements of another and may play a role in impairments in imitation in autism. There's been quite a bit of work in this area. Some of the early studies, I think the first study was by DiPreto, where she did fMRI while individuals were both imitating and observing other people's emotional expressions. And she showed that children with autism had reduced activity in the mirror neuron system in the inferior frontal gyrus. The way in which we conducted the study, this is a paradigm that had been used in the typical literature quite a bit, where you measure over the sensory motor cortex here, it's basically in the alpha range of EEG, and you're looking, what makes it different than other alpha is the fact that you're measuring it over sensory motor cortex, and the fact that it suppresses both during when you're imitating another action as well as when you're observing another action. So the typical adult paradigm is you show this little apparatus here. You also show them when someone is just holding their hand above it, and then you show it when they're actually grasping, and then you ask people to imitate that action as well. And what Raphael Bernier found, this is, he did this for his PhD thesis. You see Sarah Webb was involved in this, and also Michael Murius. And he found that in the observation condition, so when they're just observing individuals, that the individuals with autism failed to show the normal suppression of mu wave activity. So what people are doing now is trying to adapt this kind of paradigm so that it can be used with infants, you know, trying to set up paradigms that infants would be interested in, where they're not looking at somebody holding onto a piece of wood, but rather they're, you know, looking at things with objects that babies play with, and in the attempt to be able to downward extend this measure into infancies. Peter Marshall is doing some of the best work in this area. The other measure, though, is this measure of cortical connectivity, which is particularly interesting because a lot of people are talking about autism as a disorder of disconnection. In fact, Pat Levitt, I don't know if he's in the crowd, but you know, he wrote along with Dan Geschwin what now is really considered a seminal article defining autism as a disconnection syndrome, where it appears that you know, areas that usually act in coordination with each other are not really becoming coordinated with development. So the nice thing about this measure, you're essentially looking at the phase relationship between two regions of the scalp in the EEG, you know, within a frequency domain. And you can look to see whether the phase of that, you know, the signal that's going up and down, whether it's not correlated or it's highly correlated. And the degree to which it's correlated suggests that, you know, there's some connection, whether it's across the scalp or through a subcortical, one can't really know. So we decided to use this measure of cortical connectivity. This is the work of Mike Murius, who was a postdoc in my lab when we did this work. He now is an assistant professor at UW. And what I've mapped here, this is a study with adults, and we looked at two different kinds of coherence, short range, which between two regions that were closely connected, as well as long range connections. And the things that are mapped in red in terms of two between two electrodes are areas where there was a significant difference between the autism population and the normal controls, and it was in the direction of lower coherence. So what you see here is that mostly in the frontal region, you see lower coherence, right, in the mapping of connections in these short-range connections. Where, and this is actually a map of the long-range connections, and although it just looks like a big glob, if you were to plot the percentage of these that are connections between the frontal cortex and other regions, you'd find that the vast number of these are really connections that are frontal to other regions. So that's, again, a very interesting measure to think about, looking at how the brain becomes connected with development, with a measure that can be used with young children. So another area that people have been interested in is this idea of head circumference, and particularly because we do know that from MRI studies that we've done at University of Washington, as well as many other places, that enlarged brain is probably the most well-replicated anatomical feature of autism. And so head circumference is highly correlated with total brain volume up to about age 12, and so it's a nice proxy. And it is something that pediatricians regularly measure when you go to a pediatric well baby visit, so it's something that can be easily followed and documented. So what we know is that about 88% of children with autism show a very atypical pattern of early head growth. About 66% of children with autism show this to a very abnormal or extreme degree, whereas only 6% of the typically developing children, if you think about just the bell curve, show this kind of early trajectory. So this was the first very kind of well-designed study, although there's been many since, and there's all kinds of methodological issues we could get into in this area. But anyway, Eric Kershane published a paper in JAMA in 2003, where here is the CDC norms. You've got the 50th percentile here, and you could see that somewhere around, you know, 2 to 4 months of age, it starts to go off the normal trajectory, and by, you know, 12 months of age, it was about one standard deviation above the mean. So in our lab, we replicated this. Now, these are data not taken prospectively, but taken from medical records of head circumference that was just plotted in the medical records from well baby checks. And we replicated the same phenomenon. You can see that these are kids with autism following the trajectory here early on. And then you can see here, most of the kids are above the mean. But we wanted to, because these data were longitudinal, to use growth curve modeling to get a sense of what is the pattern of development over time. And as we looked at the data, it looked like that most of the acceleration was happening early on, and that the rate of acceleration was not maintaining after 12 months of age. So when we did a different models of growth curve, what we found was, so this is a Z-score. So if you were showing a normal pattern, you know, you should be going right along here in development, which is that relative to norms, your Z-score is zero. And you can see that, you know, between in the first year of life, this is 12 months, you see this rapid acceleration off of the mean, but that after 12 months, there's a plateauing, right, where, yes, they're above the mean because they've gotten up here, but they're no longer have the same rapid rate of acceleration. And so suggesting that whatever is going on might be more robust during the first year of life. And there is some data now, and I try to review the data in this article, that suggests that autism is also associated with a worsening of symptoms in, you know, infants that are followed prospectively at about the same period of between after 12 months of age, where you start to see a decline. So in our early videotape studies, when I looked at both early onset and regressed kids, what we found was that even the early onset kids worsened in their symptoms between 12 and 24 months of age. And so one of the concepts that's being talked about is this idea that regression in the second year of life may be a more universal phenomenon, and we're looking at kind of degrees of regression from some individuals who have virtually normal development and then regress, or some kids who are symptomatic already and then regress. But it does, you know, suggest that there's a very dynamic process going on here, that and we want to be able to intervene before whatever's happening during this window that seems to start at about 4 to 6 months and has some sort of dramatic course during this period of development. So we did another study. This was a master's thesis by Lauren Elder, where she looked at the head circumference trajectories of 75 children who were infant siblings, and then looked to see whether the pattern of early head growth trajectory was predictive of the development of autism by age 2. Now, we only had MCHAT measures, which is a screener of autism at age 2. So this is a measure of the number of symptoms of autism that the child was showing at age 2. And these are all infant SIBs. And we now have classified the children as having a high number of symptoms, medium, or very low. And you can see that you know, the children that had the highest level symptoms showed the most dramatic rise, and then this is the you know, the falling off of rate of acceleration over that period, suggesting that maybe, you know, these atypical patterns may ultimately help predict, and in fact could be used as a screener if you have a child with autism, just not as necessarily diagnostic, but just another risk marker that your child may be at greater risk for going on to develop autism. So in summary, I think the main point here, which is a real paradigm shift, is that rather than thinking of autism as a static encephalopathy, right, where you have these genetic hardwired changes that are there in the brain and that's autism, we see that autism is a very dynamic developmental disorder with dynamic postnatal changes in brain and behavior. So this then kind of leads to this idea, too, that there may be cumulative risk factors, and these could be genetic risk factors combined with environmental risk factors, and we can talk later about what some of those might be, that then lower the threshold to this vulnerability for suboptimal development of the brain. But we want to look at the idea that brain-environment interactions are additional risk processes that contribute to the development of autism, and that's the concept that I want to introduce and talk about now. So the concept here is that we know that autism is associated with a variety of genetic and probably environmental risk factors. But these risk processes that appear to occur early in life, you know, these could involve, they could be biological. So, for example, some people have speculated that this rapid period of brain growth could be inflammation, right? So if that's a process that's occurring biologically, you could actually intervene with that medically, right, and reduce inflammation through a medical intervention. But the ones that I've been focused on as a psychologist are the idea that there are experiential risk processes, namely that if you have this atypical brain development where you're then becoming very object-oriented and not engaging socially, you're essentially not getting social and other kind of stimulation of those brain systems that underlie language and social development. And so that what we may then see as autism at by age 2 to 3 really is the result of these both risk factors and these risk processes. And that the full syndrome could be a function of both of these. Furthermore, it's important to keep in mind that experience can influence the expression of certain genes. So we know now through some of the work with animal models that even things like licking pups will influence whether certain genes that have to do with cortisol and stress mediation. And so you can imagine that there could be a feedback process, even in terms of genetic expression and how that might influence development, that then would feed forward and actually increase the impact of these risk processes on later outcome. So then the idea then would be that intervention during this period would be particularly helpful, and that it even raises the possibility of whether if we intervened in this period, either behaviorally or ultimately if we understand better the biology, you could imagine intervening medically, that you could prevent the onset of the full syndrome. So I just want to talk about a couple of studies that were done in collaboration with Pat Kuhl that underscore this idea of the impact of early experience in shaping brain development. And so I'm going to talk about language because this is an area in which this has been well studied. Most of you probably know the phenomenon that babies are born with the ability to detect differences in the phonemic features of all the different languages in the world, but that they lose the ability to be able to make that distinction for languages other than what they are exposed to during early life. Chuck Nelson has gone on now to demonstrate a similar phenomenon with face processing, that babies early in life, the way he did the study is that he showed infants at 3 months of age pictures of humans and monkey faces, because we are, as adults, are not very good at distinguishing different monkeys, right? But we're very good at distinguishing human faces. And he showed that young infants below, these were 3 to 4 month old infants, were actually very good at distinguishing the monkey faces. But they lost the ability to do that over the first year as their exposure and interaction, with faces was with only humans. And then they even published a second study that where they changed this by providing stimulation with monkey faces, right? So they had mothers showing their infants monkey faces in a storybook and were able to retain the ability to perceive the difference in the monkey faces. So that was derived from this work that Pat Kuhl and others have done on speech. So what Pat did was she did a study where it was actually President Clinton who asked her at a White House conference on child development. Remember those old days for some of you who are old? In the crowd, and President Clinton turned around. He was very interested in this idea that exposure to language and so forth. He said, well, what would it take to be able to retain this ability to perceive different languages? Because if you could just show, put an auditory, like a auditory recording in the crib of a different language, and you could retain this ability, wouldn't that be great? And then people wouldn't have accents, and they could learn language and so forth. And she said, well, I don't know, but if you give me some money, I will find out. And so I had a program project at the time, and we had a and they put it as an administrative supplement to the program project on autism. So I'd be reviewing the budget, and it would say, you know, neuroimaging, genetics, development, blah, blah, blah. And then down at the bottom, it was called The President's Question, right? So that's what the title of her grant was. And this is the study that she actually did. So she went and had English-speaking speakers go over to China and to stimulate Chinese babies with the sounds of English. And then she did the same thing over here, where she had English-speaking American babies exposed to Mandarin Chinese to see whether you could then retain the ability to perceive the speech in these different languages. Now, the interesting thing is that she had the marvelous idea of adding an extra condition. She presented the stimuli in two ways. One was with a live speaker, where the baby was socially engaged with the speaker while they were receiving the information. But the other was through the television, right? The baby was watching the television and even kind of interested in it, but it was exactly the same stimulus. So they actually videotaped, you know, the experimenter, so it was exactly the same, but delivered over a monitor. And what she found was that indeed, if you expose the babies to this other language, they retain the ability to make those discriminations of phonemes, but only if it was delivered live and not if it was delivered through the videotape. And that's very interesting, and that has led Pat to develop a really revise her model about the development of speech perception, where she now is emphasizing the role of the social brain as a gating mechanism in the development of speech perception. So I'm going to tell you how she's linked this to autism, and then I'll just show you one slide from a publication of hers where she presents this new model. But then to apply this to autism, the question would be, okay, so maybe these kids with autism are having trouble with speech perception. Well, first of all, do they have problems with speech perception in making these phonemic discriminations? But, you know, is that related in some way to their attention to a social speaker? So this was just a correlational study where what she did was to, first of all, look at the baby's preference for a speech versus non-speech sound. And I will show you that in a minute. But then she used ERP to look at whether the, and this is actually not babies, this is children. These are three-year-olds with autism versus kids with typical development. And she looked to see whether the ERP determined that the brain was distinguishing between two different phonemic sounds. So here are the ERPs, right? And what she did find is, and it was kind of surprising because I think a lot of people think of autism as mainly a language disorder involving pragmatics, but not necessarily involving the phonemic aspects of language. But what Pat found in these three-year-olds with autism was that they were not showing a differential ERP to paw versus baw. Whereas with typical kids, you see this nice separation to those two speech sounds. But then what she did was to link this in a correlational way to their preference for two sounds. So the way the sound paradigm worked was you have two speakers in the room, and if the child looks at the speaker that has the sound of motherese, which we'll hear in a second, that speaker comes on. If you look at the other one, then the non-speech sound comes on. So you can control what sound you listen to by where you're looking. And so if they looked at this speaker, it sounded like,
"We have some little toys to play with, sweetie pie. Let's pick some out."
Whereas if you listen to this, experimental paradigm way, these two sounds are matched on all of these different acoustical features in a very elegant way. But anyway, what she found was that there was really a high correlation between whether or not the child preferred listening to speech sounds and attended to them, and the ability to perceive these differences in phonemes. Now, it's correlational, so, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean causation, but it was an interesting study to see whether or not those changes or those two things would be correlated. Here's Pat's new paper. So this was her old model. I'm not going to walk you through all of this, but what you can see now is that she's added this very nice social aspect where she talks about the importance and how social interaction is really influencing the development of language brain circuitry during the first year of life. Okay, so we're talking about here when we think about these risk processes that may be intermediate between the early risk factors and the ultimate outcome. You know, what we really want to do is to develop an intervention where we can alter this trajectory, both in brain and behavioral development, by facilitating this social engagement process, which we hypothesize to be so important, not only for development of social interaction, but as you can see, for the development of speech and other aspects of cognitive development. So rather than intervening here, which is when typically kids do receive intervention during this period, where it's going off the normal developmental trajectory much earlier, we'd like to be able to intervene much earlier. So I'll be telling you about a study where we start with 18-month-olds, and we're looking to see how much we can alter this trajectory. We've just launched a study now where we're beginning with infants at risk down in this period, and it'll be interesting to see whether this has even a more dramatic effect. Now, ultimately, we want to be able to develop biomarkers or genetic susceptibility genes or other kinds of genetic markers that will allow us really to detect infants at risk from birth, so that the screening can begin, the intervention can begin in the first year of life. So what are the potential effects of early intensive intervention on brain development? We don't know. I mean, that's a completely really unstudied area. We don't know the answer to that. But it is interesting that if you look at the animal studies that have looked at the effects of early enrichment, right, stimulation on brain development, the effects are really widespread. You see differences based on the amount of enrichment in the early environment in things like the weight and thickness of the cortex, the density and affinity of neurotransmitters, the number of synapses, modulation of gene expression. We talked about that, the effects on gene expression of neurotransmitter pathways, transcription of neurotransmitter-related target genes, long-term potentiation. And I think some of the most interesting studies are ones where they develop an animal model of risk. So for example, risk for the development of seizures. And then through early intervention, they can mitigate that risk. And you won't see the expression of that epilepsy syndrome in the animals that have received the early stimulation, which I think is more similar to what we might be seeing in autism. So how can we measure the effects of early intervention on brain organization and activity? Well, as I implied earlier, we now have a whole arsenal of very wonderful measures that we can use with young infants. And I refer you to this nice article, 2008 article. Again, I'm just featuring Pat today like crazy. But Pat goes through the advantages and disadvantages of a variety of techniques. So certainly EEG and ERP. But we also have MEG, which is Pat and others are now using with young infants. There are some beautiful studies being published now where they're using fMRI while the infant is sleeping. So Eric Kershane published a study recently where the infant during sleep is exposed to language sounds, and you can do functional magnetic resonance imaging during infant sleep. And then this other new technology, near-infrared spectroscopy, which allows you also to look at hemodynamic changes in the cortex. And so that, I think that now that we have these tools, we're really ready to ask the question of how does intervention actually affect brain development. So we have conducted a study that was designed to begin to chart this area, and I want to just tell you about the results of that study, and I'm not going to show you any brain data. We're now analyzing that, but I'll show you the behavioral outcome data, and I can also show you the kinds of measures that we're using. So in this study, this is funded through the NIH START Centers program. It's being done at the University of Washington in collaboration with Sally Rogers at UC Davis. The intervention begins at these are children with autism, not infants at risk, but it begins between 18 and 30 months. So the oldest child was 30 months of age, but most of the children are between 18 and 24 months of age. It's a randomized study where they're randomized to receive the intervention or to receive the what's available in the community. And we provide, you know, the diagnostic assessment, a recommendation for the kind of goals that the child should be trying to achieve, and then referrals in the community for intervention programs. It's a two-year intervention where we try to make sure that the child is receiving 25 to 30 hours a week of structured intervention a week. It's the hardest study I've ever done, and I thought EEG was hard until I did a treatment study, and then I realized, you know, anybody in here who's doing treatment research, you know, honestly, it is so hard. All that, you know, fidelity of implementation and training these therapists, and oh my gosh, it's amazing, and the logistical issues of being in people's homes for that much time. The model that we used for the intervention is called the Early Start Denver model. So this is a downward extension of a model that Sally Rogers has been developing for many years. The teaching practices are, from the area of applied behavior analysis. There's a preference for naturalistic teaching strategies. But we also, if the child is not responding to those, we add more structure, and we'll even offer a traditional discrete trials approach for a child who isn't responding to naturalistic approaches. But it combines these approaches with relationship-based approaches, so you don't have to be either Lovaas or Greenspan. You can be Early Start Denver model. So there's a focus on affective engagement. So for example, one of the things that Sally developed is something called the social sensory routine, which you do as a part of every treatment session, where the focus is on affective engagement and play without toys that is face-to-face with the therapist. Before I tell you about the outcome, the treatment is delivered by highly trained paraprofessionals and overseen by a person who is a board certified behavior analyst but trained in more naturalistic approaches, with a consultation from a multidisciplinary team, including a speech language pathologist, occupational therapist, pediatrician, and a clinical psychologist. So the outcome measures include all the kind of behavioral measures that one would expect in a study like this. But the novel thing is that we are also looking at event-related potentials to faces and also to speech, so we can test now PATH's theory, because we've randomized the kids into treatment versus not, and look to see whether it changes their ability to make these phonemic distinctions. And then we're also looking at EEG coherence, so we can see whether the intervention has any impact on how the brain becomes functionally connected as measured by EEG coherence. So what are the important features? It's individualized, it has a multidisciplinary focus. As I said, naturalistic applied behavior analytic strategies, deep involvement of parents, so there's a parent training component, and parents are expected to deliver a certain amount of hours of not what I would call treatment, but using the strategies throughout their daily routines with the child. There's this focus on interpersonal exchange and positive affect, shared engagement with joint activities, and language and communication are taught inside a positive and affectively based relationship. So this really underscores this idea of the critical role of social engagement in teaching, in development of both perception and cognition. So a quick little example of a child in the study. Let's see if I can do this. This is a child during their diagnostic session, pre-intervention. And so this is Jess Greenson, who is a clinical psychologist doing the ADOS. And this is the mother over here. The child actually has quite a bit of language, but never directs it to people. But rather what she does is to repeat certain phrases over and over again about blocks. Or she had a few preferred phrases and interests. So if you watch this, it goes on and she doesn't engage socially at all. This is after 6 months actually in the treatment, and this is at home working with one of our trained therapists. And you can see how it helps.
Book. Do you want the pegs or the book?
Book.
Book. I want the book.
We take a lot of strategies from behavioral response training, so this choice is a very key part.
Turn the page. Okay. Duck. Can I have some?
It's just a microwave or something in the background. There's a
can
nice
I have some?
Referential gaze.
Yay. Can I have some? Nice job. Five little ducks went swimming one day over the pond and far away. Mother duck said,
quack,
quack, quack, quack, quack. But only four little ducks came back.
She waits until
four little ducks went swimming one day over the pond and far away. Mother duck said, quack, 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 quack. But only three little ducks came back. Three little ducks went swimming one day over the pond and
one of the things about these
far away,
mother duck
said,
they look like they're just these kind of
quack, 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 quack.
But only two little ducks came back. What prompt she's going to use, how many times she has to cross, etc. It's actually a very sophisticated intervention, but it's, you know, delivered in this play kind of context.
Two little ducks went swimming one day.
So I'm going to actually show you some outcome data, and I wasn't able to put the standard deviations. I just put this together a couple days ago, and I couldn't figure out how to do that. I used to have somebody else do that for me at UW. Anyway, so you don't have the SD, so I'll have to talk about that. But this is the first time I've shown these data. It's a randomized clinical trial, and here it is. Ah. Okay, so here is the effects on IQ. And what you can see is that we do get an effect after 1 year that actually continues at 2 years. Nice, I think, robust effect. Here is the effects on the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Composite Score. And one of the interesting things you see here is how the kids in the community group are, you know, getting worse, farther and farther behind over that two-year period. So kids here now are around 4 years of age, right, because they're about, you know, two. So they're around four here. And whereas the kids in the intervention group are, you know, kind of hanging in there. They're not getting worse, but they're, so there is a significant difference. Here's the social age equivalent on the Vineland. And what you see here is that really no differences at 1 year. And that has a lot of policy implications, right? In other words, you want to wait? You wouldn't want to give up at this point, or say you only need 1 year of intervention, because by 2 years you start to see the separation, you know, with the kids in the treatment group doing better in terms of their social age equivalent. Of course, they're still delayed in that they're, you know, they're, what, 48 months, and they're on average, you know, between 25 and 30 months of age. But they're only four, you know. I mean, kids could be in the intervention for another couple of years before kindergarten. So what I want to talk about now in the last minute, because I see I'm done, and I'm this is fine, I only have a couple more slides, is that, you know, what we found was that there was, like most people, tremendous variability in response to intervention, where some kids did extremely well, and like the little girl, you know, she went on to be a great responder, and then other kids, despite having this very high quality intervention, you know, made progress, and it was important, but very, very slow, never developed language, or, you know, and still had very severe seriatopies and so forth. So clearly, there's, you know, these are not one autism. These are autisms, right? And there must be something very different biologically about the child who can respond versus not. So one of the, I think, really important things, whether we look at genetics, neuroimaging, and other things, is to try to understand what accounts for variability. And this is a longitudinal study that we did, kids from 3 to 6 years. And you can see that this is using this growth mixture modeling approach. And you can see that approximately 40% of kids do better, you know, this better trajectory over time. This is communication skills on the Vineland. But, you know, 60% of kids are showing this kind of pattern, right? Now, these aren't kids in an intervention study per se. They're just kids in the community getting all different kinds of interventions. But, you know, there's some very different developmental trajectories here. So one of the things we did in this particular study is to neuroimage the kids before at each of these time points. And we tried to look at whether there was anything on this is structural MRI now, that could predict which kids went on to have a severe trajectory versus a better course. And, you know, we didn't only, MRI was one thing that we looked at, but you can think of many, many biological predictors of response, right? Genetic markers, there's interest in peripheral biomarkers, head growth trajectory, MRS, which allows you to look at certain chemicals that exist in neurons, dysmorphology is one that's been already been looked at in the literature, gender, electrophysiological responses. So we need to begin to integrate these biological predictors into our intervention studies. We did publish one paper on that longitudinal sample. This isn't an intervention study, but just a longitudinal sample where we tried to look at whether MRI predicted which kids had a better course or not. And what we found was that amygdalar volume was a pretty strong predictor, actually. So what I've plotted here is the growth trajectories using growth curve linear modeling in that same sample of kids I showed you, 75 kids that were following longitudinally. They're now teenagers. But anyway, these are kids who have IQ one standard deviation below the mean, and also have a large amygdala, right? So larger amygdala predicts poorer course. And these are kids who have IQs above the mean and a smaller amygdala. Now, what I don't show you here is that you get the amygdala effects when you do a regression analysis after you partial out the effects of IQ. So it predicts above and beyond IQ. And this is the kind of study, I'm not saying this is kind of a rough study in a way, but it gives the concept that we really need to be including more of these kinds of measures. So in this paper, I've also talked about some predictors of response to treatment that we can look at in terms of behavioral profile. And what I propose in this paper is that what we might be looking at is three highly comorbid disorders, right? One being autism, really, which is captured by these indices of social engagement. So it might be measured by early social initiation, social approach, smiling, social orienting, and so forth, response to social reinforcers. But there's also this mental retardation comorbidity. Okay, we'll end. And this could be measured by rate of learning, IQ, toy play. And then third, is you do see kids who seem to have a comorbid specific language impairment, which I think has its own overlapping domain that is separate from the autism. And the irony is the kids who have only autism have the best prognosis, and the kids who have all three have the worst prognosis. So I'm going to end there. Sorry, I went a little bit over my time, and I just want to end by acknowledging all my collaborators at the University of Washington, and I acknowledge my supporters, and thank you for hanging in there.
Okay, I think we have time for about two questions.
Yes. Beth.